think perhaps we ought to get started. I know the subject this morning ran over a little, but the consequence of that is that we're rather short of time than we hoped to be this afternoon. So I propose to alter the order of battle and ask Stephanie to start. We've got, as a topic this afternoon, options for reform in counter-terrorist detention, which I hope I shall find a rather more cheering session than the two we had this morning. Painted for those of us who are specialists in the area of this really grim picture. We are very happy this afternoon to have Julia Ford with us, who is a human rights lawyer and an expert with very good experience. Shami Chakrabarty, who is very well known to us, to those of us who live in Britain, as one of the stalwart defenders of our few remaining liberties, and we're very glad to hear Shami this afternoon because she will be talking much more about the UK case, which I think will be a very useful counterbalance to some of the discussions we've had this morning. And Stephanie is going to begin by giving us a presentation about reforming the laws of war. She comes from the University of London Royal Holloway College and is going to give us a PowerPoint presentation.
Yes, it's a little tacky, but I thought first panel after lunch I probably should have some colour. We all like color. So thank you very much. And also thank you to Elizabeth for organizing this really great conference and for inviting me to speak on this panel. What I'm going to speak about today largely has to do with a book that hopefully will come out at the end of this year, probably early next year, largely about how we got from, in terms of the laws of war, kind of we went from this low point of Vietnam, by and large, to kind of arguably, and I say arguably because I understand this is not sacrosanct, but a legal high point perhaps in the 1990-1991 Gulf War, where even organizations like Human Rights Watch and Middle East Watch argued that while it wasn't exactly a happy conflict, it did by and large accord with the principles of the laws of war. And then finally, how did we go back from that high point down to that low point again of Abu Ghraib, war on terror? So kind of how we went from there and back again. What I'm going to focus on specifically today, however, though, is some of the reforms that were put in place in the post-Vietnam War period, and whether or not we can look, basically what happened post-Vietnam, and then are there any lessons that we can learn from this kind of period of kind of restructuring and rebuilding in terms of the laws of war to the post-Iraq period? When we think about Vietnam, we often, you have used it in the past couple of years as a big comparison with the Iraq War. Sometimes I wonder about the historical accuracy of this, whether this is or is not appropriate. The Philippines might be a better example. But I think there is a good reason why comparisons are made, and that is, rightly or wrongly, we both have this sense that the Iraq War and Vietnam were perhaps unfortunate conflicts with unfortunate consequences in terms of the laws of war, or unfortunate legacies in terms of the laws of war. Certainly this is the case with Vietnam after the My Lai story broke in November 1969. With regards to the laws of war in Vietnam, even though we might have this kind of unfortunate association with it, it didn't exactly happen in a legal vacuum. And I think this is one of the most important things to remember, that actually going into the conflict by the early and mid-1960s, the U.S. actually did look very well placed to do quite well with adherence. They had recently signed the Geneva Conventions, 1951. They had recently created the Uniform Code of Military Justice less than a decade earlier. And there were lawyers on the ground, there were rules of engagement in place, and, the commanders, the military commanders, were actually quite open about supporting the laws of war as part of the ongoing operations. Still, there is a reason I'm up here talking about Vietnam. It didn't really work out as well as hoped. Now, there's many reasons why this is so. I'm going to do a brief summary, in fact, because I don't think I could go into all the factors, so I'm calling this section the five-minute way to really screw up your war. The first bit is, of course, jurisdiction, and I think it would be fair to call Vietnam a conflict with an identity crisis. It was never entirely clear whether it was an international armed conflict, a non-international armed conflict, or a non-international armed conflict with international aspects to it. And I think in this sense, there actually might be some parallels here with the war on terror. Obviously not perfect, but in terms of a conflict with an identity crisis, probably. Secondly, with the battlefield, and this is an element that's been brought up time and time again, but basically it was really hard to distinguish who was a combatant, who wasn't a combatant. There's no distinct battle lines in terms of territory. And to quote one of the lawyers who was in fact there at the time, he said, quote, "The battlefield was nowhere and everywhere, with no identifiable front lines and no safe rear areas. It involved combatants and civilians from a dozen different nations. Politically, militarily, in terms of the law, in terms of international law, the Vietnam conflict posed problems of deep complexity. The inherent difficulty of attempting to apply traditional principles of international law to such a legally confusing conflict is well illustrated by the issue of prisoners of war." Now, what's interesting is that all combatants taken in Vietnam were given Geneva rights. This was, it's not entirely obvious why this was the case. I think it might have been just quite simply a good PR move at the time. Vietnam, despite the legacy, was of course a war for hearts and minds. And I think to a large extent this was an attempt to help stem international criticism. A lot of the problems came up when the troops that the Americans had in fact taken were transferred to the South Vietnamese, who of course had a very different view as to what was going on. Also, there was some hope for reciprocity with the treatment of American prisoners of war taken by the North. That never really works out. But basically, with regards to combatants and prisoners of war, it was the first time in more than half a century that the United States was faced with combatants or a force that refused to adhere to the laws of war as they were conventionally understood. And there's a good deal of frustration with this environment that followed as a result. And I think, of course, this frustration played a huge role in the violations that took place. Thirdly, actually, conditions for lawyers. From what I can tell, there really didn't seem to be any idea or grand scheme of what the lawyers exactly should be doing in Vietnam. There was no real plan of action. You read the accounts of these lawyers, and they were often sent there with basically a JAG manual, a manual for court-martial, and a yellow legal pad. And they're like, go get them. And that was pretty much it with regards to their guidance. So with regards to how the laws of war were effectively monitored or implemented, it pretty much was very much up to the individuals who were, in fact, on the ground, and that there was no real systematic way to deal with the levels of crime committed by demoralized conscripts who were in the field. This brings me to the last point, training, and I would like to focus on this just a little bit. But the conscripts who were sent to Vietnam received their first law of war training in their during their basic training before they were sent over. This training was largely academic. It was not well connected to reality or, shall we say, practical circumstances as perhaps it might have been. And it really was kind of tacked on as a part of their training. So, in other words, here's your job, kill, kill, kill. Oh, and here's the Geneva Convention. And this was found to be problematic later, this kind of check-off-the-box approach to training. Further actions, well, you're supposed to receive further training in the field. There was some, from what I understand, some pretty, I'm going to use the term lame films that were made that really, again, did not reflect reality as soldiers were experiencing on the ground. There were these 3x5 cards. I've got some pictures of them up here as to what were handed out. But it's called The Enemy in Your Hands. And these were issued to American soldiers in Vietnam outlining the basic requirements of the Geneva Convention. But these measures fell quite short. By 1969, 50% of the soldiers in the field had not had adequate or enough training. And secondly, I think more importantly, that really we have this kind of clash of ideas that is present. At this time, particularly by the late 1960s, we have this pressure for body count. At the same time, the Geneva Convention is trying to bring about restraint. These two ideas are not going very well together. So I think there's a lot of confusion created in the minds of soldiers. We have the Pierce report into the My Lai massacre, why that massacre occurred and what the recommendations were, which was released in 1970. And it found that the soldiers who had taken part in the My Lai massacre were woefully inadequately trained or improperly trained, particularly with issues with regards to obedience to illegal orders, the Geneva Conventions, and how to treat prisoners of war. It was acknowledged, again, that this training that they'd received was abstract, it was academic rather than concrete and practical. And interestingly enough, the training they received put more emphasis on the right if you yourself were captured rather than what to do with a prisoner of war who had, in fact, been taken. So ultimately, I think all this combined together, this poor leadership, weak discipline, inadequate training, to basically create this kind of frustrating environment, which was a recipe for disaster. Now, having said out that, I wanted to now just quickly look at the post-Vietnam reforms so we can set that up for comparison. Now, some of the problems, in fact, solve themselves. One of the major things, the end of conscription, it's much easier to teach the laws of war to an all-volunteer force, for example. But more importantly, I think, to a certain extent, was the establishment of the Department of Defense Directive 5177. Now, this was the first overall law of war directive, which set out the specific duties and responsibilities of the laws of war and training for military personnel. And it also required you to, as you can see from the above list, to report when war crimes occurred. Importantly, the final point there, that your training was supposed to be commensurate with your responsibility. Now, this is all very well done, and it certainly set an important kind of new role for the laws of war in the department. But really, if you think about it, probably a lot more could have been done in the immediate aftermath of Vietnam. There wasn't an immediate push for change. Well, why was this? Well, lawyers in the law had received a lot of the blame for losing the conflict. They were seen as having put restraints on policies that the military wanted to do, and therefore the laws of war had a pretty bad name within the Department of Defense. And to talk to one military lawyer, he described it as having a very hostile client. So to confront this situation, I think we can look at probably two kind of parallel developments which occurred in the Department of Defense, which was kind of the reinvention of the laws of war as operational law, and the second was activist lawyers. By the first one, I mean it was basically a massive PR campaign for the laws of war within the Department of Defense, that you're trying to rebrand the laws of war not as these kind of bureaucratic restrictions come up by a bunch of old guys in Geneva, but rather basically a positive tool that you could, in fact, use for your military operations. Now, the basis of operational law, or the concept of international law, is, of course, the laws of war. But it also brought together every single legal aspect in a military operation that was possible that could be kind of packaged together. So domestic law, regarding intelligence oversight, or contracts for goods, or status of forces agreements, all of these things were brought together into one legal package that could be used for planning. And therefore, again, rather than presenting the law as restriction, we're presenting the law as something that set out the rights of the military as well. And I think perhaps you could raise a criticism here, you know, is this anti-humane, kind of using the laws of war to actually prepare for war? Leave that for the discussion. The second major development, I think, is kind of these activist lawyers who came from the Department of Defense. These were lawyers who basically had been to Vietnam, and because of the unconventional nature of the conflict, later went on to bring these kind of, you know, because they had to act unconventionally in Vietnam with regards to the law. And I think they brought back a lot of this attitude to the Department of Defense and wanted to change the way business was, in fact, done. And they effectively tried to push their way into the planning of military operations. Before this point, lawyers were actually not even allowed in the war room or in any kind of planning environment. But they were effectively able to convince, eventually by the 1980s, to actually be allowed to be in the war room and help with this kind of planning operation. Additionally, and as a final factor, there's by the 1970s, there's actually a large number of lawyers that are in the Department of Defense at this point, and these lawyers were better educated than they had ever been before. And actually, by the Gulf War, the ratio of American military lawyers to all other allied lawyers combined was 70-1. If we look at the operations, we can kind of see the transition. I just go through these quickly. Going through Grenada to Panama in 1989, Operation Urgent Fury, lawyers were still not in the planning process. The first lawyer to find out about the operation found out a few days in advance. The first lawyer on the ground was given 12 hours notice that he was going to be deployed. So that was considered to be a step, but not quite where the lawyers, in fact, wanted to be. However, they did actually do a fairly good job on the ground with regards to prisoner of war and detainee issues. And again, this kind of bolstered support for their cause. This was also through the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which kind of reorganized the Department of Defense and played a large role in kind of increasing the role for military lawyers in the chain of command. And so by the time we get to Panama, actually, the lawyers were well involved in the process, months in advance. By the time they got on the ground, the rules of engagement were already set, already put there, and by and large, the lawyers had by this point been fully integrated into the planning process. Is this a good success? I would argue that the first Gulf War indicates that this probably was. Even though it's a legal war, this of course does not mean it wasn't incredibly destructive. But arguably it was fought according to the laws of war. So by this point, I think we can probably argue to a certain extent that law had once again, at least in the eyes of the military, become respectable. That activist lawyers in operational law had worked very hard to restore the reputation of international law, and they had succeeded to a large extent. And this is why I came up with the title Legal Revolution, because I kind of feel that there was a cultural revolution with regards to, cultural revolution's a little harsh, but at least with regards to the laws of war in the Department of Defense. And I think we can summarize it in these three points. First of all, the law of war was incorporated into training. It wasn't just tacked on. Secondly, the activist lawyers and the rebranding of international law worked to effectively create a culture of respect. And finally, that the officials, not just military officials, but also government officials, expressed a commitment to these reforms and a commitment to this attitude. And that I think this is incredibly important because it expressed one clear message of what was expected of the troops, and that was they would adhere to the laws of war. Now, I don't want to basically recap what's already been said about the Bush administration. So what I'd like to look at now are basically some options, like kind of looking at these lessons of the post-Vietnam period. What are the lessons we can take from this and put towards Iraq, or the post kind of Iraq environment? I think the laws of war really very much, like their implementation very much depends on a culture that supports them. And under the Bush administration, part of this culture was diminished through I think, statements of the Bush administration and confusion as to whether or not the laws of war applied. We've already talked this morning about the tactics from Guantanamo moving to Afghanistan and then Iraq. And even in pop culture, I think, I don't really watch 24, but I think this is Jack Bauer throttling his brother. Sure. But I with regards to pop culture, even this kind of glamorized torture to a certain extent. And there was a huge problem, actually, with trying to get soldiers not to use what they had learned on 24 on the soldiers in Iraq. Because the shows like 24 actually showed that torture worked, and this was not a good thing. So I think, kind of this problem of kind of this culture kind of diminishing was a big problem. So what should administrations do? What should the Obama administration do? Well, I think they firstly need to show unequivocal support for the laws of war that the U.S. is obliged to adhere to. And I think this could be done through, A, issuing statements, orders like closing Guantanamo. I think this is a good step. Or even perhaps ratifying treaties like the Additional Protocol 2, which Reagan said he would do in 1986, but still has not happened. I think the moral argument against torture needs to be raised, and this perhaps can come in as a part of training. And really importantly, the U.S. will be, or the U.S. military will be re-releasing a law of war manual later this year or early next year, coincides with my book. It's just a coincidence. But in this book, I think this would be a really great opportunity for the U.S. to basically kind of commit itself to the laws of war. Secondly, the next generation. Like Vietnam, those lawyers who were in Vietnam had basically taken their experience and tried to improve what had happened within the Department of Defense. Will this happen again with those military lawyers who are serving in Iraq? We certainly have already seen individuals willing to speak out within the Department of Defense. There were those who spoke up against the military commissions. And I think, I said earlier in the comment section, but really to a certain extent, military lawyers have sometimes actually been the Bush administration's biggest opponents. Will these individuals set up new programs and ideas? Now, I think the only problem with this might be that actually, you know, the laws of war don't perhaps have the same bad rap as what they did in the 1970s. So I don't actually know if, you know, this is as necessary, it will be as effective, but who knows? It could be a good thing that, I think by and large, the bad rap that the laws of war have, if any, is that they weren't implemented enough rather than being than them hindering the operations. Training. I think this is, again, a very important point. The approach which was developed to basically incorporate law of war training, not just how you do your job. You're not just trained to do your job and then get law of war training tacked on at the end, but actually this is combined. So you learn your job, which will be in accordance with the laws of war, not just something that's tacked on. The two are taught together, not separately. I think this works really well when everything is in the box, as it were, if everything is going according to plan. But what happens when this is no longer the case? And I take in point a personal experience. I have a friend who I interviewed it was a PhD at the time, and now it's the book. But he was in Iraq, and basically he said to me, you know, I got there, and suddenly I found myself running a town. And I'm sorry, but I'm not entirely sure you could ever really properly train for that. So, you know, there's a question here. You can't really train. That's going to come down to issues of judgment and, you know, and what, you know, I'm not really sure adequate training is there. So what are the options here? Well, should we actually, was it part of the problem that the laws of war actually, that the approach that they took to training actually disguised the law too much? So in order, you know, the original strategy was to hide the law because people were hesitant in putting it together. But, you know, is it actually that now we need to actually make the law more explicit? Do not do this because it's against the law. Or is it, should we look into ethics training for military soldiers? You know, after Haditha, the military announced core warrior value training, things like this. And I put this point up here, and I did put it in brackets, but do we actually want soldiers thinking? And this sounds maybe a little bit harsh or ridiculous, but to a large extent, you know, these people are trained with drill, these people are trained with discipline, and if you start having them making kind of like ethical judgments, and, well, maybe not ethical, but like kind of questioning everything in the middle of a battlefield, it might actually lead to disaster. So I think there's some balance between the two needs to be made together, and perhaps we can, anyone wants to talk about that in questions, ace. What I think is clear that more training might be needed. If you looked at the Abu Ghraib reports, it was found that the reserve soldiers who were sent to Abu Ghraib did not have the correct training that they were supposed to have before they went to the camp, to the detention center, and I think that played a hard part. And my final slide here, what are the challenges again? Well, it's very hard to actually instill a culture. If trying to instill a culture of respect for the laws of war is the way forward, it's going to be quite difficult. A survey done in 2007 revealed that 40% of Marines and 55% of soldiers would still not report someone in their battalion who had committed a law of war offense. We still have problems with private military firms with regards to how do we, you know, what with regards to jurisdiction. Don't really have time to go into that. And finally, the asymmetric warfare, which you can probably expect to be the continuing conflicts of the, coming century, will probably be in this nature. And they're just not easy to mesh with the laws of war. It's challenging. It's difficult. We need to respect that difficulty, but at the same time, we do need to promote this kind of culture of respect for the laws of war. Thank you. I don't know if I should shut this off because it's going to make noise, but could do you want to shout in the microphone?
I don't have any visual aids, but I am now standing up, in case you hadn't noticed. As you've heard, my perspective as the Director of Liberty, which, for those of you who don't know us, is the sort of British poor cousin of the ACLU, my perspective is essentially British rather than American or even transatlantic, and is primarily concerned with our domestic war on terror, as opposed to that, though I may make some observations on our own military, but my primary focus is on the war on terror at home in Britain, since 2001. I'm sure you've been discussing this all day, and I, of course, haven't been here, but I probably don't need to point out to this audience that the concept of the war on terror in itself brought certain logical, cultural, and practical consequences that were really quite dramatic here in the United Kingdom. And of course, Britain has had a fairly rich recent past when it comes to dealing with terrorism, the troubles in Northern Ireland in particular. And yet, I think one can argue that the war on terror rhetoric and policy and solidarity with the United States brought about some really quite dramatic changes in UK domestic anti-terror policy that are almost an inevitable concept of buying in to a war on terror. I think it's also worth pointing out that unhappily and unluckily, for a country that doesn't have a written constitution and an entrenched Bill of Rights, our own Human Rights Act here in Britain was less than a year old in terms of being in force when the Twin Towers atrocity took place. Now, of course, as you can see from the United States example, even great democracies with very well-established bills of rights and written constitutions are going to be, to some extent, in turmoil. There will be inevitable tensions between executive and judiciary, in particular, in a period of this kind. Unhappily, in Britain, the human rights culture was really very, very embryonic. As I say, the Human Rights Act that was passed in 1998 by the youthful and exuberant New Labour government led by Mr Blair was not brought into force until October of 2000 and therefore had been in force for 11 months when 9/11 happened. And that's quite important for context as well. In my work in the subsequent years, I've spent a lot of time in London and elsewhere in this country, speaking to sort of liberal, progressive audiences who fell for a time into a kind of smug anti-Americanism, smug or nervous anti-Americanism that kind of went along the following lines. At least Blair isn't Bush. At least Belmarsh is not Guantanamo. Now, there may be a certain, a certain merit, a certain logic in both of those statements, but there is a third twist which was mentioned less often, and that is that these periods in the history of great democracies do kind of come to an end. And as we're now beginning to see, you're allowed to call yourself an American in Europe now because it's fashionable again because of President Obama. But at the end of the war on terror, if, as we hope, we can now say that that period in history is coming to an end, you Americans in the audience have President Obama, and you still have your Bill of Rights framework intact, a little bruised and battered and brought into disrepute perhaps, but it is still there as a constitutional instrument. Whereas now, as we approach the end, hopefully, of the war on terror in Britain, there is a great deal of interest in repealing the Human Rights Act, which, as I say, was barely toddling to its feet when 9/11 happened. So there is a very, very interesting compare and contrast that we won't be able to do properly, perhaps for some years, about what the long-term legacies will be of the war on terror on each side of the Atlantic. And ironically, we could in Britain end up being a lot worse off if the eventual outcome is repeal of the Human Rights Act, as at least one main political party is now calling for, with possible replacement with some instrument that's much more focused and contingent upon nationality. There's lots of talk of a British Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, sometimes with a subtitle with common sense. And if you want to know what that means in forensic terms, it means with the possibility of deporting foreign nationals to places of torture. Now, that's all sort of by way of preamble, but I think it is quite relevant to what the war on terror meant at home here in Britain. Now, of course, from a hawkish point of view, it was a disaster, because what you did was you allowed homegrown British terrorists like
infamously Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, to say, "We are at war and I am a soldier." And of course, British governments of both colours during the Troubles in Northern Ireland had ruthlessly resisted allowing Northern Irish paramilitaries to call themselves soldiers and to have anything that resembled military status, because of course that's what a paramilitary wants. So the war metaphor was a really massive departure from that idea, that traditional British approach, which is essentially a criminal law approach rather than a war type metaphor with all that comes from that. And that, I think that is significant for a country that had a fairly rich history, even in the recent past, of dealing with paramilitary activity. From a more sort of dove-like liberal perspective, of course, a war on terror brought some real problems as well. The first, of course, is that you've got this embryonic Human Rights Act. You've got a traditional criminal law approach, but notwithstanding the wonderful things we've been hearing about laws of war and so on, from a domestic civil liberties human rights perspective, a war is, to some extent, a period of emergency where domestic populations know that they are going to have to depart from the norm to some extent, and they're going to have to give up or compromise on some of their normal rights and freedoms as they would understand them. So, for example, here in London, during the Second World War, you know, Winston Churchill came to Parliament and said with a heavy heart, "We're going to have identity cards and blackouts and rationing and all these things, and I long for the day when I will return to this House of Commons and hand all those rights and freedoms back." Now, of course, in the middle of the Blitz in London, nobody knew when that conventional war would come to an end. It was indefinite, like the war on terror. But unlike the abstract war against an abstract noun, we the people would know that the war would end one day, and we also knew that that we would be able to measure and verify the end of a conventional war with our own senses. There would be, you know, the end of hostility, bombs would stop falling, a peace treaty would be signed, some objective way to measure the end of a traditional conflict, not waiting for, I don't know, George Bush the 52nd to say, "One more push, guys, and the war on terror would be over," or Tony Blair the 52nd for that matter. So essentially, from a sort of human rights perspective, domestic civil liberties perspective, a war on terror goes on forever and is in danger of being a permanent state of emergency. As Mr. Rumsfeld would have had it, you know, a new normal, a long war. And of course that is in inevitable tension with the whole concept of a framework of rights and freedoms against which you measure anti-terror or other forms of policy. Just throw it all out of the window. Or as Mr. Blair told us, in the aftermath of the London bombings in the summer of 2005, the rules of the game have changed. And of course, if the rules of the game mean no torture, free speech, fair trials, personal privacy, and if those are the rules, then we're losing quite a lot. And the question then is, what is the template against which you measure the legality and the general approach of your anti-terror policy? The game, I'm assuming, was national security. So inevitable cultural changes coming just from that one amazing piece of Bush White House rhetoric, but very much taken up here in London by Mr. Blair and co. And the first obvious example of that, it's been described by Helena Kennedy, one of our Labour peers and a famous criminal and civil liberties lawyer, described as an act of solidarity, was the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act of 2001. This is passed as emergency legislation. We legislate a lot in Britain, and particularly in the aftermath of a devastating event, whatever it is. Now, this was the piece of legislation that was passed as emergency legislation. That means passed in a matter of days through both Houses of Parliament in December 2001, following on from 9/11. And the most dramatic aspect of that piece of legislation was the idea that foreign nationals, suspected of links, loosely defined, with international terrorism, would now be capable of indefinite detention without police interview or charge or trial. And this was going to be achieved by derogating from Article 5 of the Convention on Human Rights, the European Convention, Article 5 being the right against arbitrary detention, the right to liberty. And it was going to be achieved by the following very creative jurisprudential logic, which is that there were people in Britain, as there always are, a small number of people in Britain, who cannot be deported to their home countries because they would be tortured there. And the European Court of Human Rights, in a famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, a famous case called Chahal against the United Kingdom in 1996, had said, no, the prohibition on torture is so absolute that it's not just what you do by your own hand and it's not just what you do in your own country. You can't send people for torture either. Now, this is uncontroversial to some of us, particularly now in the light of extraordinary rendition, but it does, believe it or not, cause a great deal of consternation across the political spectrum in this country and in parts of the media and so on. So, so people in Whitehall had been worried about this so-called Chahal problem ever since 1996. And after 9/11, the whiz-bang idea that was achieved was that if we can't deport these people to places of torture, because we can't derogate from the right not to be tortured under the European Convention, because that's the one absolute no-no in the whole human rights framework, what can we do instead? Well, what we can do instead, in a time of war or other emergency threatening the life of the nation, that's the test, as you know, for derogation under Article 15 of the Convention, what we can do is to derogate from the right to liberty. And we can effectively intern these people instead of deporting them. And this was the big controversial policy contained in the 2001 Act. And the then Attorney General, the now famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Attorney General Lord Goldsmith, described this policy in the House of Lords, where he had to defend it, as a three-walled prison. The idea being this was immigration detention, not criminal justice detention, administrative immigration detention. These people were free to leave Britain at any time if they so wanted, but of course on the government's own case, they could only leave to go to a place where they would be tortured, three-walled prison. But if they didn't want to go, they were going to stay banged up in Belmarsh for the rest of the foreseeable future. And this was all justified on the basis that they were foreign nationals. If they were British nationals, they would not be covered by this policy because British nationals are not subject to immigration legislation, to immigration control. So ironically, some of the original dozen or so suspects who were detained, some of them in the end for some years under this policy, were detained for associations or suspected associations with a gentleman who was preaching fire and brimstone at Finsbury Park Mosque, who could not be subject to this kind of control because he was a British national. And this, again, I think comes from the idea of a war on terror. Wars, conventional wars, your own citizens, other people's citizens, you start treating them in different ways. And of course, you know, instead of the criminal law, which generally involves treating nationals and non-nationals alike and dealing with their actions and charging them and so on, you go for this kind of attempt to separate on grounds of citizenship. And this was how the government justified that internment policy in 2001 and thereafter. Mercifully, for all sorts of reasons, not least for the future, our House of Lords Judicial Committee found against the legality of this policy under the Convention of Human Rights, under the Human Rights Act, in December of 2004. So after 3 years' detention, these people, the remaining detainees, most of them, were told that this policy of detention was incompatible with the Human Rights Convention. Why? Not because there wasn't a public emergency threatening the life of the nation, though one law lord, Lord Hoffman, thought there wasn't and dissented from the majority, but because this was an irrationally discriminatory policy. the view being, a view, by the way, that was backed up by what happened in the summer of 2005, the view being that British nationals were just as likely to be terrorists, and yet they were completely untouched by this policy, which irrationally and discriminatorily picked on foreign nationals who were subject to this indefinite detention in circumstances where their British counterparts could walk the streets free. And this reasoning, by the way, has subsequently been backed up by the European Court itself. Now, what the government did in response to this judgment, which is probably, I was talking to Lord Bingham last week, probably the great constitutional case of the war on terror in Britain, and comparable with our Liversidge and Anderson during, which was about internment in World War II. What the government did in response to this declaration of incompatibility, which, remember, did not involve a striking down of primary legislation as it would have done in another country like the US. It has no only moral and political and persuasive weight. What it did was to say it would change the policy. So indefinite detention was abandoned in favour of something called control orders. Now, control orders differ from Belmarsh detention, firstly because you do not go to prison. You remain effectively under house arrest at home. So that was seen to be a more proportionate approach and therefore more likely to pass muster with the courts. And secondly, the control order regime applies to British nationals and non-nationals alike. But I think to go back to how the war on terror changed the British government's approach to dealing with terrorism at home. Traditional anti-terror law in Britain, particularly in the time of the Troubles, the Prevention of Terrorism Act and those policies that in that vein and which followed the 70s and the 80s and so on, was always essentially modelled on, broadly speaking, criminal law. Now, it might be a slightly bent or stretched or bastardised version of the criminal law that allowed you to detain people for longer, perhaps incommunicado and away from lawyers for longer. But essentially, if you're a criminal lawyer and you look at some of those traditional British statutes of the Troubles and beyond, you would recognise that we're talking about criminal offences, maybe a little easier to prove than usual, criminal procedure, maybe slightly tipped in favour of prosecution, but sometime soon somebody is going to the Old Bailey for a Crown Court trial. What happened post 9/11 was a departure from that criminal law paradigm and a move initially towards administrative law in the form of immigration control, and secondly, these control orders, which in their own way can be traced back to earlier New Labour experiments in blurring the distinction between criminal law and other regimes, like the civil injunctive regime. So those of you that know anything about sort of home affairs policy may have heard of antisocial behaviour orders, which have been very popular here since 1998 as a tool for dealing with sort of petty crime and nuisance. You haven't actually committed a serious offence, but we get an injunction against you, and you breach that injunction, you've committed a criminal offence. Control orders are loosely modelled on that, save that you don't even get civil evidence. It's all secret intelligence and dealt with behind closed doors. The Home Secretary suspects you. It's all based on secret intelligence. You won't get to ever hear a case against you, but a special advocate appointed by the Attorney General may test some of the intelligence on your behalf. Control orders, by the way, are still on the statute book. So surprise, surprise, I'm going to suggest in this idea of options for reform that we get rid of control orders. There aren't very many of them around, and actually senior sources in government and in the security services now say, what's the point? We've got a few miserable people who are sitting on them indefinitely, never been charged with anything, under house arrest. I'm going to suggest that we row back from some of the other worst excesses of this period. We managed to defeat an attempt last year to extend pre-charged detention in the proper criminal sense. We managed to defeat 42 days, but it may be time to row back the clock from the current 28-day maximum. And also, I think, to explore the one bit of blurring of regimes that the government didn't do, and that is finally to put Britain back in step with other jurisdictions like the United States and allow the lawful, rational use of intercept evidence in proper, full-blown criminal trials, which I think would be a very, very sensible way to say that the British approach to anti-terror has to get back to a criminal law model, as opposed to all these lovely, creative, jurisprudential experiments in blurring administrative law with criminal law, blurring the civil and criminal law. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, that gave you a taste of what's going on in Britain.
With apologies for coming late, but I hope I won't be debited at the end for those moments. I want to thank Elizabeth for inviting me and to LSE for hosting this seminar. I have two preliminary comments to make. With apologies to Jane, I've been asked not to comment on the United States. And we can save that for a later period. I am deeply involved in what is going on in the United States and working with one specific task force, and we can bracket that for now. I was asked to not cover the UK, and therefore I am tasked with covering the rest of the world. And I will do. I will do. The second comment I would like to make is I've noticed more than once in the course of the day when people say Human Rights Watch, they turn their head and they look at me. I think it's very important to say that I no longer work for Human Rights Watch. And the comments that I make here today are purely my own. It's been a very short time, and so the identity crisis is still quite acute. I'd like to begin my comments by making some conceptual and definitional clarifications, right? The difference between an option for reform and an opportunity for reform, and the difference between accountability and reform. And I think there is a lot of confusion in the air right now about what constitutes what. First of all, options for reform. There are a billion options for reform. Pick a country, pick their criminal legislation or their special anti-terrorist legislation, pick their policies and practices with respect to counterterrorism and human rights, and you will find dozens and dozens of options for reform. And what I mean by that is places where, within their legislation or their policies or their practices, what they are doing does not, in fact, conform legally with their human rights obligations under domestic law or under international law. There is a difference between an option for reform and an opportunity for reform. And I would argue at this particular point, the United States notwithstanding, I think we do need to bracket a situation that is in such extremis. There are very few opportunities for reform in Europe at present. Very few governments are looking at their counterterrorist legislation, looking at their practices and saying, this just doesn't look right to me. It's violating human rights and I really think we need to reform it. So I really want to make the distinction between the title of our panel and what I see as a real dearth of genuine opportunities for reform. In the same vein, it's important to note the difference between accountability and reform. Right? There are accountability processes in a number of European countries. Just last week, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that indefinite detention was in fact a violation and gave modest but did give compensation to some of the persons who were detained under the indefinite detention regime under the Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act of 2001. That is an accountability process. There is accountability process for secret detentions in Poland, about which a little bit more. There is an accountability for a CIA rendition in Italy. There's a German parliamentary inquiry into rendition in Germany. Ireland has had quite a process. The Spanish have investigated renditions. So in terms of accountability, it's not a desert. But what will come out of those accountability processes in terms of genuine reform is what I'm more interested in. And in fact, I suspect I will be extremely disappointed as the years go by. Having said that, let me begin the formal presentation, which will look at three instances where reform is either possible, where reform was possible, but the opportunity was not taken, and where reform was possible and the opportunity was taken. But let me just give you an example of what I mean by an accountability process where you've had all sorts of formal accountability, but no reform, no meaningful reform. And I look for a moment at Sweden, a very well-known rendition case, the rendition of two Egyptians in December of 2001. The Swedes apprehended these men on December 18th, handed them over to CIA agents. They were abused on the ground in Sweden. They were abused en route to Egypt. They were sent back to risk of torture. They were, in fact, tortured. This was one of the few cases, I think, where we have, you know, from start to finish, a fairly well-detailed example of how rendition occurred. And there have been numerous accountability processes that accompanied trying to find who the perpetrators were of this. Sweden implemented a parliamentary constitutional investigation. The Constitution Committee investigated. The parliamentary ombudsman investigated. Cases were brought before the European Court of Human Rights. Unfortunately, were not admitted on a technicality. There were two very good decisions from UN treaty bodies, one from the Committee Against Torture and one from the Human Rights Committee. The Swedish government admitted that they did wrong. They rescinded the expulsion orders of these two men. They offered the families of one man visas so that they could remain in the country. And then finally this year offered compensation. And to our knowledge, the first compensation that's ever been paid to rendition victims, to both of the men. So investigation and prosecution didn't occur, but we had all sorts of other accountability. And what has happened since then? The Committee Against Torture recommended that Sweden reform its Aliens Act to provide persons who are subject to national security expulsion with more procedural safeguards. And Sweden, in fact, did this. Right? So there was a reform of the Aliens Act. Prior to this reform, if you were a national security suspect subject to expulsion in Sweden, you did not have a right to challenge your expulsion. Which is another way that Sweden was able to justify in some ways the original removal of these men without any process. So the Aliens Act was reformed, very limited, but still some procedural guarantees were implemented. But what Sweden did in the meantime was they publicly said that they would not reject in the future the use of diplomatic assurances to transfer people who were subject to that expulsion process. So while they gave people procedural guarantees so that they could get their foot in the court, they also stripped them of the justification for the fact that they would be at risk on return by saying, nope, we've gotten these assurances, you're actually not at risk on return, you have no grounds for going into a court and challenging your removal. So with the reform came the maintenance of a tool that really stripped the reform of any meaning. Right, so I think we just need to be very cautious about what we're talking about in terms of reform. Again, having said that, let's move on to some examples where there have been opportunities for authentic reform, some taken, some not. And I would like to look at Poland, I would like to look at France, and I would like to look at Denmark. And for each country, there's a story, and I realize this time of day is very, you know, it's very nap time. So I'm hoping that the stories actually keep us somewhat alert. The first issue I'd like to address is secret detention in Poland, because I was very mindful of Elizabeth's, she was very correct and very aggressive and assertive in saying, let's stick with detention, let's stick with deprivation of liberty. So we'll talk about secret detention in Poland and the options for reform there. Pre-trial detention in France, and a very unfortunate missed opportunity. That was a really, really a real disappointment in terms of reform there. And then reform with respect to immigration detention in Denmark. Okay, so let's take Poland first, only the most egregious case. What is the prescription for reform for secret detention? Right now, we know that the national prosecutor in Poland has jump-started, because there was an investigation, a prior investigation into this, but has jump-started, has breathed new life into the idea that he is going to get to the root of secret detention in Poland. Okay. And a Polish newspaper just recently revealed that they had evidence, hard evidence, that the Polish government, or the Polish security agency, actually allocated 20 of its agents to the United States to assist with these transfers that were occurring in and around Poland. All right. Now, when you look at it on its face, there's no such thing as the reform of secret detention, right? The only reform for secret detention is to stop it. It is fundamentally illegal. There's nothing about secret detention that can be reformed to make it conform with the law except by stopping it, right? The key to secret detention in Poland, though, was really because the cooperation between the security services, between the CIA, and between Polish security services was under the radar, completely under the radar. Very little oversight of CIA counterterrorism actions on the US side, no oversight on the Polish side. And so what I would say, if the Polish national prosecutor really wants to do this the right way, there will be an investigation, there will be prosecutions of any operatives who were involved in the secret detention, the alleged secret detention, and then there will be reform, and the reform will come in the form of a very specific piece of legislation that provides for critical civilian oversight of the intelligence agency in Poland. Right. This is an opportunity that presents itself currently because Poland is doing this. I think this is a prescription for every country that has been implicated in any way in secret detentions, which would include, well, of course, the United States. The United Kingdom, vis-a-vis allegations of detentions under the radar at Diego Garcia, Romania, Poland, Morocco, and Thailand. Right? Those are the places where there may be opportunities because those countries are named. But again, I would say, in conformity with Martin Scheinen's report, Martin Scheiner is the special rapporteur on counterterrorism and human rights at the UN, who released really what I think is an excellent report on the oversight of intelligence agencies and their conformity in their practices with international human rights obligations. He just released that, I think it was in January or February. I think it's critical reading. So in Poland, what we have right now, I think, is an experiment. And if the advocacy community, the legal community, those of us who are following these developments and doing advocacy on them want to make Poland kind of draw a line in the sand, I think we may have an opportunity with Poland. Now, I'm sure the skeptics out there will say Poland's relationship with the United States is so close, that's why they hosted the sites to begin with, etc. Let's put some money on Poland's desire to really be in the community of human rights respecting nations in Europe, to truly assume its European identity as a civilized liberal democracy and go from there. So one type of reform then, absolutely critical at this point in time, is oversight of intelligence agencies. I'd like to move on from that, an abuse that is almost breathtaking in its enormity, to something a little more mundane that has been going on for years and years and years, particularly in France and Spain. But let me use France as an example, and that is the issue of pretrial detention. The French have done a very good thing in the last year or so. They've established a commission called the Leger Commission, headed up by Philippe Leger, who's an eminent jurist, to look at the criminal code and the code of criminal procedure in France with a specific eye toward systemic reform. France was criticized very heavily by Amnesty International this year for police abuse practices, criticized by Human Rights Watch. Look at what I've just done. Criticized by Human Rights Watch for counterterrorism practices that violate international human rights norms, etc. Well, to their credit, they've established this commission. In advance of the commission, of course, the commission did the right thing. They elicited submissions from civil society about what various civil society actors thought was wrong with the code and the Code of Criminal Procedure. And Human Rights Watch submitted a document that had three very simple points, and they were all on counterterrorism practices. Counterterrorism practices are incorporated into the French criminal code. There is no separate legislation. First, the definition of association, criminal association with a terrorist undertaking, which basically is a crime in France for you to get close to anything that looks terrorist. All right. It's a very vague definition. It does not require a step taken toward a criminal act. All right. So it is very much rooted in the notion of association. Who you are hanging out with will determine whether you could be subject, whether you could be found to be committing a crime. Right. So let's narrow that definition so it has more meaning and is not so broad. Second, no use of torture evidence in terrorist criminal proceedings in France. Right now, it is left solely up to the discretion of a judge as to whether evidence that might be extracted under torture can be admitted or not admitted. There's no objective test. And third, shorten the period of pretrial detention in France, which at this stage can last for over 3 years. You can be in detention in France for 3 years and renewable for another 4 months while the investigation is continuing. Right? So this very carefully thought out critique on all of these measures was submitted to the Leger Commission with high hopes on a couple of things. And when the Leger Commission issued its preliminary report just last month, not one provision in the criminal code or the code of criminal procedure dealing with terrorist crimes was subject to reform. Others were. You know, other periods of pretrial detention for, say, drug trafficking or minor felonies, it's like they took every provision that dealt with association with a terrorist undertaking and bracketed and said, we're just not going to touch this. The Leger Commission had an initial report. They will issue a secondary report. And I'm really hoping that with more advocacy, et cetera, that they can be brought around to actually even just looking at this basket of provisions. But I don't have very high hopes. And I do see this as a missed opportunity. There's not going to be another commission like this in France for decades. And that was a missed opportunity. And it very much relates back to this notion that terrorist crimes are seen as exceptional, and they can't be touched. And in addition, not a lot of public pressure. The last example I'd like to talk about right now is actually quite an interesting one, and of course it involves our Northern European friends because it is an issue. It's an example where there actually has been some real reform. If you all recall the cartoonist Hullabaloo, that doesn't give it the respect that it deserves. But you'll remember the 12 cartoons that were published by Yelen Postin in 2005. Well, one of the cartoonists' name was Kurt Westergaard. And last February 2008, two Tunisians and a Dane were arrested on suspicion of plotting to kill Kurt Westergaard. They were plotting to strangle him. Because all the evidence is secret to date, we don't know how they determined that they were going to strangle him as opposed to poison him or shoot him or whatever. But in any event, the accusation is that these three men were planning to strangle Kurt Westergaard. The men, the two Tunisians, were immediately put into immigration detention. The Dane was freed. The question arose in the public's mind, in the opposition's mind, why immigration detention as opposed to, if you have evidence and you've arrested them, why are they not in criminal pretrial detention pending charge and trial? The Danish intelligence agency, PET, we call it PET, I don't know what the Danish is for it, actually went to court to prohibit a trial
They did not want these men tried. They said that the evidence was very sensitive, that it would, and this should be something that we are all very familiar with at this point, it would hinder the conduct of foreign relations in the Danish government if they were to release any of this evidence. What Pet wanted was for them to be detained in immigration detention until such time as they could be deported. Well, the Danish Human Rights Foundation said they cannot be deported because they'll be subjected to torture in Tunisia or other fair trial violations. Pet went back and said, all right, fine, we want them detained then. We want them detained indefinitely. All right. So we had in Denmark a situation where we were looking at people who were going to be detained indefinitely. Well, we knew that wasn't going to last very long. Eventually, one of the Tunisians decided that he wanted to go home. He left voluntarily. It should be pointed out, undermining the idea that he would have been at risk of torture. However, his point of where he went back to has not been disclosed by the security agency. The other Tunisian actually filed to be released and was released and granted a temporary permit to stay in the country pending proceedings. In the meantime, the Danish government, in response to public pressure, pressure from human rights groups, and pressure from the opposition, has promulgated or has promised to promulgate a piece of legislation that would permit the men to be tried in a court. They have rejected the idea of using immigration detention as a proxy for pretrial detention with charge and trial, which is a good thing. They have agreed that they will give the men process, which is a good thing, that they will try them based on the evidence, which is a good thing. All right, that is a reform. What will remain to be seen is whether this legislation includes a trial that would comport with fair trial grounds. So far, the intelligence on that is that the trial would be held in secret, so it wouldn't be a public trial. All right, so this is a big problem, right? Right. I see you nodding. It is a big problem. But again, there is this period right now in the run-up to the drafting of this legislation and the tabling of this legislation where lawyers, academics, and others can go to work on what is essentially a blank slate and say, look, if there are national security concerns, here is how they can be managed. And they can almost always be managed. In camera proceedings, special legislation to deal with national security information, I personally am not a fan of special advocates, would never argue that special advocates should be used. But there are ways of managing this. And so I see this right now in Denmark, the same way I see Poland as one of the few opportunities where there is some movement, where we can actually effect some change that would be long-lasting in terms of a real reform. Okay, so while I started off on a very negative note, I think I whipped myself up into some form of optimism in the meantime. I do think that while what's going on in the United States is really just bringing us back to the status quo ante, and that is not progress. That's not progress. And I think we shouldn't think about it as progress. The 42-day detention victory, again, bringing us back to the status quo ante, where 28 days is still a serious violation of liberty and security of person, right? And I would argue that we shouldn't settle for the status quo ante. Had September 11th never happened, had Guantanamo Bay never happened, had the Bush administration not implemented all of those policies that they did implement, these extreme, outrageous, kind of breathtakingly horrific policies, we still would have been criticizing them for things like use of secret evidence, for things like putting terrorist suspects into supermax prisons in Florence, Colorado, where they have sensory deprivation for 23 hours. I don't think we should forget that just going back to the good old bad days is the right answer. If we're looking for true reform, we have to kind of identify the opportunities that exist and hone in and go for really serious, long-lasting reform that does pair security with human rights, not doesn't pit security against human rights. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for a very helpful view of what's been happening in your extend the discussion after the break. Are there questions now? Thank you.
My name is Hassan Goliaga. I'm from Coventry University. I've got one question for Stephanie. You mentioned as needed reforms in the law of wars, the ratification of treaties, protocol number two. What are your thoughts in regards to the Rome Statute of 1998, International Criminal Court, and the implications on the law of wars for US and jurisdiction over, obviously, US soldiers? And if I may put a second question to Shami directly afterwards, you mentioned the need or, to be a good thing if the UK would have a Bill of Rights, a written constitution. If I got that right, how do you evaluate the new UK Supreme Court possible influence on actually pushing policymakers towards a Bill of Rights or a written constitution for the United Kingdom? And do you see an opportunity for the European Court of Human Rights to push with further case law possibly coming up for the establishment of a Bill of Rights within the United Kingdom?
Brown, International Relations Department, LSE. My question's for Shami Chakrabarti. You said you felt the war on terror was over. My friend Norm Jeras runs a website in which he uses the Prince analogy. He says we have the conflict formerly known as the war on terror, and he's now got up to 18 fuckwats, as he calls them, where people have used the language which has everything except the phrase war on terror. So we're still fighting terror. So what I'm really asking is, do you think the word war has quite the significance you're suggesting? It seems to me very little has changed. The arrival of Obama, I think, is making minimal difference. But the second question is, it's related to that. One of the points you made was that, you know, the British refuse the Irish terrorist prisoner of war status. Absolutely correct, but this is before your time, but the NCCL asked that they argued they should have a special status. They argued that these were not actually common criminals because they, you know, their motivation was totally different from that of ordinary criminals. So are you saying that nowadays there is no distinction between what people who try to blow up London tube trains do and what, for the sake of argument, we call common criminals do? Is there nothing here that requires some kind of special arrangement?
Sorry, my question is for Stephanie as well. In terms of the framework of international humanitarian law, and particularly you mentioned additional protocol 2, what you've got is a problem where a lot of the conflicts now require local armies. So in the case of Ethiopia, you've got the Joint Task Force for the Horn of Africa, which is US-based. So you've got these international elements to conflicts that are taking place. You've got the internal conflicts that are taking place as well, internationalized conflicts. And obviously, without ratifying all the different additional protocols, you have different standards of international humanitarian law that could possibly be applied to each scenario. So how would you suggest that the US goes about actually ratifying additional protocol 2, which obviously has very strong ramifications in terms of the rights it has to give to others, as well as then bringing that within the rest of the framework?
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'll ask the panel now just to respond and draw together their thoughts. Stephanie, would you like to start?
Sure, thank you. Can you all hear me? I'm North American, so we talk loud. First of all, the question on the ICC, I think that's a really interesting question. It's not going to happen. I don't see any way it's going to happen. I would measure progress in actually something like Convention on the Rights of the Child. If we can get a Convention on the Rights of the Child through Obama, we're doing well. I think also progress might be measured in not actively trying to undermine the court. So, just, okay, you guys do your little international criminal court thing, we're going to be over here. But thirdly, I think this is often overlooked, is you know, the international criminal court is not the only way to practice international criminal law, and that the U.S. has spent a lot of money and a lot of time supporting the special court in Sierra Leone. That court's running out of money, so hopefully it'll give it some more support. But, you know, the special court for Sierra Leone is a hybrid court. It's arguably a very effective court. And, you know, I mean, if the U.S. wants to continue doing that, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have a problem there at all. It is a really interesting question to see where it's going to go. I say this because I was in The Hague 2 weeks ago, and we had a meeting with the State Department officials talking about this, and they're like, yeah, no. So let's push for Convention on Rights of the Child and go from there. With regards to different standards, this is a really interesting question. It's actually been a huge issue since the 1980s, the issue of legal interoperability in NATO, because you had so many different NATO countries that have signed AP1, AP2, and the U.S. has not. I always suggest, I mean, I think just look at U.S. practice. They tend to adhere pretty much to AP1. Clearly not always, as the Bush administration will demonstrate. I think the Law of War Manual will be an interesting statement on this, what they decide is customary, what they decided to do is policy, and I think that will play, by and large, a large part in kind of this interoperable issue. I mean, I'd love to see them sign AP1 with the same kind of ratifications that the UK put on AP1. I just, again, culturally, I just don't think it's going to happen for, you know, what I have to say is ridiculous reasons, but reasons that are nevertheless there. And, for example, if you do look at the issue of landmines, the U.S. has not signed the landmine treaty, probably will not sign the landmine treaty, but the U.S. is no longer using landmines. It will probably, I think, as of this year, no longer have any active landmines anywhere in the world. So, you know, the question is with regards to, and Mike's saying no, but I think that's pretty much it. No, they're going to be deactivated. Yeah, it's pretty much gone. So there you go. They're not going to do it anymore, but even though they won't sign it. So they'll say it's a matter of policy and not law, but, you know, what do human rights activists want in the end? Do they want the effect or do they want the law?
Thank you very much. Show me.
I didn't intend to make an argument for a written constitution. If anything, I'm most nervous about permanent constitutional revolution, which is each new British government thinking that it has to have its own new fantastic constitutional settlement, which it then imposes on people with no genuine reflection or bipartisanship or cross-partisanship. And I think there are great dangers for stability in a great old democracy of doing that every few years. As for a Bill of Rights, the Human Rights Act is a Bill of Rights. It's an embryonic Bill of Rights that gets a really bad press. But it has all the features of that kind of constitutional document, save that it hasn't been allowed to acquire sort of semi-untouchable status that it needs to acquire. But no Bill of Rights currently on offer from any side of the political spectrum in Britain would be an improvement upon it. In fact, the nature of debates about Bills of Rights in Britain, whether they come from the Tory Party or the Labour Party, are about Human Rights Act minus rather than plus. It's the language of rights contingent on responsibilities, which is different from the human rights language of limiting rights in certain circumstances, and too much Britishness, too much focus on nationality, which therefore is human rights minus not plus. Is the war on terror over? I guess I was trying to be optimistic because I'm so used to being sort of miserable person at sort of public events. I hope that we might be turning a corner. I do, however, think language is incredibly important. I don't think one can overstate. Like Orwell, I don't think you can overstate the impact that an abuse of language can have on abusive policies and then abuses on people. There is a reason why people use the war rhetoric. There's a reason why kidnap and torture is dressed up as extraordinary rendition. There's a reason why we're constantly fed euphemisms to disguise practices that would otherwise be completely distasteful to the people that they're being sold to. That obfuscation is quite deliberate, I have no doubt. Did anyone from the NCCL ever suggest that the IRA should be treated as prisoners of war rather than criminal suspects or defendants? If they did, they were wrong. Perfectly possible that they did, but they were just wrong. I think one of the perverse ironies of the war on terror has been a sort of revisiting of history as if as if no one in London was ever bombed before, as if department stores and party conferences and London buses weren't bombed before, as if the gentlemen of the IRA and other paramilitary organisations were gentlemen bombers who always gave warnings and left calling cards on silver trays at the front door. That is clearly not the case. As to the question of whether there's room or a role for any special anti-terror law at all, some would argue no, including notably Conor Gearty, who is here. I slightly disagree. I think that there is an argument for certain special offences, just as you have sex offences rather than just offences against the person, on the basis that proportionately touching certain parts of the body brings special proportionate risks to touching other parts of the body, and a common assault will just not do the trick for certain sexual offences. I think there is an argument in proportionality terms for example, prescribing certain organisations, and I think you can comply with the human rights framework and be proportionate and limit certain rights. But I think you have to justify each particular measure, each particular offence, where you say that it's not enough to charge murder, or it's not enough to charge, and you just have to be incredibly precise and specific about why we need a particular offence. I think there are certain police powers, like Section 44 of the Terrorism Act, which has been so abused as a stop and search without suspicion power. There was actually an argument for a special anti-terror stop and search power, but it should have been confined to specific places on the day of the opening of Parliament, so that everybody entering Parliament Square would be subject to a proportionate, polite outer body search and bag search, because people understand that's a day of heightened tension and everyone's treated the same. Instead, a broad and sloppy law that was snuck in because of the war on terror became a power that's been racially divisive and used against peaceful protesters. So it's not the idea that there shouldn't have been some kind of measure, it's the idea that we're far too free and easy about passing such measures, and there was a great deal of very sloppy thinking, which again I think was easier to do because of this war type footing.
No, I just hope that I just hope that the U.S. can find its way to move back toward the ICC, and I augur a guess that it will depend on these initial months and how much Obama can earn in these months in terms of political chits and goodwill that will determine that. I wouldn't be so quick to say that it's absolutely off the table, and I hope it's not.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to thank all our panel and questioners this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed. I think it's been fascinating. I would like then to ask you all please to have a very quick cup of tea and come back as soon as possible. Could we thank our panel first?